And there we are. We're live. Welcome back, everybody, for another episode of In Liberty and Health, episode number 355. We're over 3 years of doing the podcast, 355 episodes. I got some returning guests for a definitely information-packed show with two very dear friends of mine at this point. So they've been on the show before, and I'm sure you guys are well aware of them. But we're going to be talking about Israel and Iran today, because that's obviously kind of the big thing in the news. And I was thankful that these guys could come on somewhat short notice. But I got another show coming at you tomorrow. I'm going to have Q Anthony Ali tomorrow to talk about China and stuff like that. So it's going to be really interesting. So I kind of get to talk about all my foreign policy topics that I'm mostly interested in this week. So this is going to be an exciting week for me. And hopefully for everybody listening and watching out there, it's an exciting watch for you as well. So I won't keep you guys too much longer here in this portion of the show. Make sure you hit all the links below to figure out where you can find my guests, everything they got going on, everything I got going on. Hit that donation link below if you wouldn't mind, or become a member on the channel to help support me financially so I can keep doing this. Because unfortunately it does cost money. It's not free to do podcasts. Other than that, deemed fit through the link below should auto populate the code SarahM25 for a little discount. Let them know that the Matovic family sent you. Tiger Fitness through the link below, and Fox and Sons Coffee. Use code Kyle at checkout. And with all that stuff out of the way, let's rock and roll.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
All right, everybody, and welcoming back my dear friends Dave DeCamp and Connor Freeman. How you doing, guys?
Good. How you doing?
Good. Good. Excited
doing
to have
very
you
well,
here.
Man.
Nice. Thanks, nice. Man. Yeah. Connor, you were just on about a week or two ago. We talked a little bit about the anti-war coalition, but unfortunately, it seems like we still got quite a bit of work to do because there's a whole lot of crap going on throughout the world right now. So, Dave, why don't you kind of let us know on the latest happenings in regards to Iran and Israel, and we can kind of move on from there.
Yeah, I mean, we're basically waiting to see if for Israel's response to Iran's attack on October 1st, which came, you know, after a whole bunch of escalations from Israel. You know, it's tough to get a gauge on what's actually going to happen. You know, from just reading what the media is saying, you know, it still sounds like Israel is planning to do an attack before the U.S. presidential election. Mm-hmm. I've seen some people say it could happen this weekend, but you know, it's like every week you hear that. So it's tough to say, but I saw something from the IRGC yesterday that made it sound like maybe this won't turn into a huge war. The senior commander in Iran's IRGC said, basically downplayed the threat of an Israeli attack. They said, oh, Israel can't do anything to us. You know, it's probably going to be a limited attack. Because before that, you know, we've seen Iranian officials basically say, if you do anything, you know, we're going to hit back twice as hard, and then it's on. So this seemed to be the first kind of suggestion that maybe, you know, if there was something limited, like what happened last time, if you go back to April, Israel bombed the Iranian consulate in Syria, killed a senior Iranian, killed a lot of people, including a senior IRGC commander. Iran attacked Israel. Israel attacked Iran. You know, we don't really know exactly what happened. The Israeli media says they damaged an air defense system, but Iran really downplayed it. And that was that. So that's a sign that something like that might happen. But at the same time, Israel's conduct in the past few months, I wouldn't be surprised if they just go all out in their attack on Iran and try to provoke this big war that they want, like right before the election. I really could see them, you know, doing something like that. And we just had this leak that Connor covered it for us at antiwar.com of the U.S. spying on Israel's drills. You know, they're preparing for something big based on those leaks. So I still do think it's possible something big could happen, but hopefully it doesn't lead to, you know, full blown war, because that'll mean that the U.S. is at war with Iran, basically.
Yeah, so I think you're coming through your laptop, Mike. It sounds like you're a little bit far away, but I'll toss it over to Connor here for a second. I want to know what's going on with that leaked plan that you had wrote a story about, Connor. And if you don't mind, also lay out some more of the history between Israel and Iran, like some of the assassinations, some of the other stuff that kind of led us to where we're at today.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, essentially, there's a really great piece from Trita Parsi out of Responsible Statecraft right now, which came out, I guess, Monday. And it ran at as a spotlight at antiwar.com yesterday. And he lays out five or so potential scenarios about what's actually happening here. One of which is, you know, apparently the U.S. investigation into the leak, at least the latest I've seen, is that they've already determined it wasn't an internal leak, that they want to say it was a hack potentially from Iran or from somebody else. And so Trita lays out the possibility that it could have been somebody within the U.S. defense establishment or even within the Biden administration that wanted this information to get out to kind of stall the attack or, you know, kind of to some degree tie Israel's hands. I agree with Dave. I don't think that's really a workable strategy at this point. In fact, U.S. officials, as soon as the leak occurred, were coming out and saying, look, this is extremely serious. However, we don't think it's going to impact Tel Aviv's plans to attack Iran at all. There's other scenarios where, you know, it could be a hack from a foreign power, could be even one of the Five Eyes allies. That would be Canada, New Zealand, Australia, or the UK, who are the only other countries that were allowed to view these documents, which were top secret. They came from the Pentagon, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, as well as the NSA. This was, you know, very highly classified information. I know that David Sanger's piece in the Times that came out shortly after my piece was published at antiwar.com, like that evening or the next morning, they were projecting that it could be like a lower level leaker who did this, sort of like Jack Teixeira, the Air National Guardsman who released that huge trove of documents on Discord early last year, which we'll get into later because there's some interesting things about Iran and Israel that were included in those documents as well. So, you know, it could have been that, it looks to me like we don't exactly know what happened yet. It could have been, you know, really somebody who's trying to stop the war, like someone making a real move here to try and get this information out. Because, I mean, you can only send so many sort of, those different cables those ways for people in the State Department, these other different bureaucracies to come out and say, hey, look, we disagree with this policy and then lodge a complaint. It doesn't really get that far. You need real whistleblowers and real leakers to come out and, like Daniel Ellsberg, this kind of thing, if you want to try and stop it. This could be a larger leak. We don't know yet. That's what apparently U.S. officials are primarily concerned with, because there were no real substantive revelations about U.S. capabilities or U.S. involvement in these attacks. But, you know, it could be the tip of the iceberg. I certainly hope that it is. One of the things that they do say in those documents, in addition to talking about the air-launched ballistic missiles, the air-to-surface ballistic missiles, the UAV drills, the refueling aircraft drills, they talk about large-scale deployment exercises. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty alarming. It also revealed that, well, what we already knew, of course, is that Israel has this clandestine nuclear arsenal. They're not signatories of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which means the IAEA does not have an inspections regime. The UN nuclear watchdog does not inspect Israel's nuclear weapons. And that gets into some other hairier territory, because technically that makes American military and financial aid to Israel illegal per foreign assistance laws that were amended in 76. It looks like they're preparing for something on this. I mean, they let everybody know when they bombed Yemen that they can actually make the distance, which was in dispute for a long time. They've bombed Hodeidah twice, and they appear to be using the same kinds of refueling craft that they did in that attack. We did have the U.S. recently bomb Yemen with B-2 stealth bombers, which was directly a message to Iran, letting them know, because we have seen these reports, as Dave's covered at antiwar.com, about how, you know, I believe it was two American officials who had told NBC that, look, the U.S. could actually do direct strikes in this attack. It's unlikely. I mean, they're probably just going to provide intelligence and maybe some logistics support. But, you know, it is possible. It's been floated, the idea of using direct strikes. And I think more or less what the real concern here is that Israel is going to drag us into a war with Iran so that we fight their chief enemy, the real deterrent in the region to Israeli supremacy and hegemony, while they finish their Nakba in Gaza with the general's plan and whatever they appear to be doing in Lebanon, which to me looks like an ethnic cleansing project, at least to the Litani River. I mean, they're calling it a security state, a buffer zone. They have all these different names for it, but there's a huge movement for, you know, settling there as well. Mm-hmm. And we've already seen some real escalations in the West Bank. And we know that Miriam Adelson wants to move ahead with annexing the West Bank. And so in order to do that, you need the U.S. to come in and fight a war against all of Israel's regional enemies who are led by Iran and the axis of resistance. And that means simultaneous war with Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, and Palestine, of course. Mm-hmm. And so that's the real risk right here. And I, for a lot of reasons, I think Netanyahu might be thinking this is the best opportunity and window he's going to have for that kind of an attack. So, but in the meantime, you know, it's like Dave said, we really don't know. We don't know what targets Netanyahu has picked exactly. There's conflicting information about whether or not they're going to hit oil facilities or nuclear facilities or just air defenses and carry out targeted assassinations of different military and political officials, or if they're going to do maybe some more covert attacks on the nuclear program, like we've seen in the past. It could be all those things, and it might not all happen on the same day. It could be a protracted attack. And, you know, I mean, particularly these attacks on nuclear sites, which is what Donald Trump is promoting most when he talks about this. I mean, that can cause catastrophic environmental disasters, the likes of which we really haven't seen. I mean, that's something that doesn't get talked about much in the mainstream media when they cover these Israeli attacks and U.S. attacks, sabotage attacks on the Iranian nuclear program. It's kind of talked about like, it's sort of like the pager attack. It's they almost pat themselves on the back for it about how adept Israeli intelligence and the Mossad are at infiltrating Iran and being able to carry off these strikes. But you know, we have not, the ramifications of that could be quite extreme and certainly would give Iran the reason to launch a massive counterattack on Israel. And if that happens, you really do have a situation here where Israel may just go ahead and use their nukes, or they may do it even in spite of something like that not occurring. I mean, this is really a totally out of control regime. There's no, you know, the American administration is not putting any reins on the Israelis. And to me, you know, what gets lost in this is that this is the neocons, like this is the apotheosis of the neoconservative takeover of the United States. And if we do go to war with Iran, it's just like, I mean, the fact that there's not people in the streets, that there's not a massive movement of resistance among the people or even among some of these really criminal congressmen and senators that we have, they should understand that this is very serious. I mean, they can talk about the genocide and call it self-defense and whatever, but this is very risky and could lead to a nuclear war because of that wild card with Tel Aviv's nukes. And so, you know, I mean, we're in very dire straits right now. And I mean, hopefully there's going to be more documents that are released, and hopefully this does, to some degree, put some brakes on Israeli plans or make them at least change their strategy. It could be even a diversionary tactic, right? I think that's one of the other things that Trita brings up in his piece, is like maybe this was put out so that the Iranians are looking for attacks to come in all the wrong places. It could be a totally different plan. But I don't think that's probably accurate because you have U.S. officials admitting that these documents are legit. And so, you know, where we go from here is really an open question.
Yeah, Dave, before I throw it back over to you, I remember you covering something, I want to say it was maybe a week or two ago, about how Iran basically said, like, look, we're not looking for war, but we're kind of done with being so restrained. And it seems like historically, Iran has always been characterized by largely like great amounts of restraint, no matter pretty much what Israel or the U.S. does to them. They're usually kind of take it, they're not happy about it, but they kind of move on and roll over. Then, you know, obviously you talked about the strike back in April, but then there was a strike more recently where I think it was just one Palestinian was killed, which, you know, go figure. But do you think that they're going to start to really kind of ramp things up then, or do you think they're going to kind of roll over again, or do you think it's kind of who knows at this point, because Israel's been such a rogue state.
Yeah, I mean, that was their message right after all this, was that, you know, and that's how they put it. They said the era of self-restraint is over. And, you know, they're referring to, you know, going years back, not even just over this past year, but, you know, there's been all these Israeli covert attacks and assassinations inside Iran. You know, IRGC officers gunned down, you know, explosions in their nuclear facilities, and Iran never really responded to those. So now that has been the message after this October 1st missile attack. And they did show that they can get their missiles past Israeli air defenses in that attack. And so they're, you know, that's been the message. But again, just the other day, had that IRGC official say, and usually the IRGC is more, you know, is the most hawkish. They're the most hawkish of the Iranian officials, is the IRGC. So to see that from a senior IRGC commander, that it might be limited, makes me think that if it isn't, you know, if it is a limited attack, if it's not anything huge, then they might back down and they might let Israel have the last word there. But at the same time, they're also seeing what, you know, a reason why I think the messaging has changed is that, you know, the Ayatollah has wanted to avoid war with Israel and the U.S. But after Nasrallah was killed, you know, I think he realized that war is coming to him, whether he likes it or not. And if you look at Israel's actions right now, I mean, they're not stopping. Lebanon, it's just they killed like over 60 people there just on Monday. The airstrikes are just destroying the place. And Gaza, they're carrying out this ethnic cleansing campaign in northern Gaza now. So they're just completely out of control. So, I think that might be part of the thinking is, all right, Israel's not stopping here. If they hit us and we don't do anything, then they might, you know, they're going to do something else. There's going to be some other big escalation. They're going to try to assassinate someone, you know, down the line. And Israel has shown that they can do things inside Iran. I mean, the fact that they killed Haniyeh while he was visiting Iran, this is Hamas's political chief that Israel killed back in July. And this was one of the reasons why Iran fired all those missiles at Israel. The fact that they killed him, he was in this guest house guarded by the IRGC. I mean, they definitely do have impressive intelligence capabilities inside Iran. So I think that's all part of the thinking, that they might say, all right, you know, we don't want war, but the war is here. So let's act like it. And then we might see a really big attack on Israel and even potentially U.S. bases in the region.
Jesus. So I wanted to ask about Lebanon, because I don't know if I had any of you guys on since like a lot of the stuff in Lebanon had popped off. We always heard about how Israel got beaten back by Hezbollah back in, what was it, 2006, I think. Are things different now? Are they, you know, better, worse from the Hezbollah perspective or what? Dave, you go take it, and then Connor, you can kind of fill in from the last two questions after Dave's done.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's still mostly been, I mean, there's a ground invasion to it, and there's been a lot of fighting on the ground in just the past couple of weeks, but it's still mostly been just an Israeli bombing campaign. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with that method, Israel can cause a lot of destruction. And, you know, a few dozen, I think, Israeli troops have been killed either in southern Lebanon or right over the border recently. So it goes to show, even with all these heavy airstrikes, Hezbollah is still putting up a pretty strong fight. But I mean, it is the firepower. I mean, they have a huge amount of firepower that they're using, but it does look like a lot of the targets are just civilian targets. They're just leveling residential buildings, and they put out these, you know, graphics that claim to show, you know, their evidence is basically like animated footage that they made to show that there's weapons in these buildings. But so I think that, Hezbollah still has a lot of fight in it. You know, and we'll see. I mean, I know the Israeli soldiers have been, you know, capturing small villages in southern Lebanon. And it does kind of seem like momentum's just on Israel's side right now. You know, I think Hezbollah did take, you know, the pager attack, the walkie-talkie attack did definitely hurt them. Mm. But it's still, you know, it's not like Israel's just rolling in there.
Yeah. Connor, before I throw it over to you, I was out with a friend recently, and hopefully he's listening to this, but he had mentioned about Hamas putting bombs and stuff on dead bodies. and had mentioned the human rights abuses there. And he was willing to acknowledge, obviously, all the hospital bombings and everything that Israel's done. But it was an interesting thing because he comes from a little bit more of a left-wing perspective, and obviously me coming from a little bit more of a right-wing perspective. It's kind of interesting that I'm arguing for the Palestinians and he was arguing for the Israelis in this respect. But, you know, I do use the term genocide when it comes to the war on, you know, basically the ethnic cleansing campaign in Palestine. But, you know, some people argue that, oh, well, that kind of brings about a certain connotation with it, right? Like we think about 100 million dead, but it's like, okay, well, you get there by leveling, what is it, 42,000 people in a year and then bombing hospitals and infrastructure. So I know that's a little bit more on what I asked Dave earlier, but go ahead and take it wherever you want, Connor.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the genocide question, I don't think is really realistically in dispute anymore. I mean, first of all, it doesn't matter what the size of the population is. What they're actually doing is exterminating an entire nation of Muslims and Christians systematically and ethnically cleansing the ones that they don't kill. And it's very out in the open now because of the plan, the general's plan from Major General, the retired IDF Major General Giora Island. That what they're doing in northern Gaza is they're basically fully blockading that entire part of the strip north of the Netrazim corridor, which bisects the north from the rest of the strip. They're for weeks now, they've prevented any aid from getting in, including food, medicine, water, any kind of basic necessities for life. They've attacked a myriad of hospitals there's only a handful of hospitals that are still operating there, but a myriad of civilian infrastructure. I mean, they're constantly bombing schools that have been turned into shelters, and they've eliminated so many of the schools now. Every university is destroyed, and these schools are now just shelters. So they bomb them routinely. They're, you know, separating men from their families, telling the women and children if they even get out to go ahead and go to the south. And of course, there's no safe areas. I believe it's more than 86% of the strip that is technically what they call a no-go zone, which you don't, if you're a Palestinian, you don't know what the hell that is. It's an invisible line. But what it does mean is that the IDF explicitly has authorization to shoot anybody they want in those areas, like they really care if they do it in outside of those areas, but they have been given explicit permission from their commanders to go ahead and do that. And, you know, we've seen reports from like 972 MAG where they talk about these IDF soldiers go, well, we kill people out of boredom. And, you know, as far as the genocide question goes, that general's plan is going to be finished in the northern part of the strip unless like Washington stops Israel, but they're not going to.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt, but what is the general's plan? Isn't that for the Greater Israel Project, or am I mistaken? Can we kind of lay that out there? Because I don't think I've laid that out on the show.
Well, yeah, the general's plan is like a specific plan for Gaza.
Okay.
Written up by these like retired IDF generals. And essentially the plan is, you know, you have northern Gaza separated from the rest of Gaza by what's called the Netzarim Corridor, which is completely controlled by the IDF. They bulldozed all the buildings there. They're setting up like military bases there, basically. So they want to move all the Palestinians south of that and then take over the north. So the plan calls for, you know, order an evacuation. And then after a certain amount of time, anyone who's left in northern Gaza is considered a combatant. So it's a closed military zone, which means you could, you know, shoot everybody on site and impose a starvation blockade. So that's kind of the outline. And then what we've seen since October 5th, Israel ordered all the Palestinians, 300,000 to 400,000 of them in northern Gaza, to leave. And since then, they've been focusing on certain parts. You know, I've seen Israeli reports that say that it's kind of a limited version of the general's plan, or like a slower, a scaled down version, as they put it. I think they're going to kind of do bit by bit. They're focusing on the Jabalia refugee camp, which according to some reports that I just read, they've cleared half of it of Palestinians already.
Was that the same camp that they bombed pretty early on, and they claimed there were a whole bunch of terrorists there?
Yeah, that was the largest refugee camp in Gaza.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was the one, actually, they just claimed there was like one Hamas guy there, and they dropped all these bombs. I mean, that was one of the big things, I think, changed a lot of people's minds who were kind of more on Israel's side in the beginning. But
Blitzer was taken aback by that when I was talking to the IDF spokesman.
Yeah, that clip was crazy. So it's like underway, and then you'll see Israeli officials say that it's not, but not even publicly. These are reports that we're getting that's what they're telling the U.S. behind the scenes. And then Blinken was in Israel yesterday And apparently in the meeting, you know, Blinken said, you guys, you know, everybody thinks you're carrying out this general's plan. And Netanyahu said, oh, you know, we're not, you know, this is very damaging to us that people think we are. And then Blinken said, okay, well, why don't you say that publicly? Say that we're not carrying out this ethnic cleansing campaign publicly. And Netanyahu said, no. And
it's like but you've had Israeli child.
Yeah, yeah. And you've had Israeli soldiers say that they're doing it, that this is what's happening. And, you know, to the media, you know, to Haaretz and things. But so it's very clear what's going on. And, you know, to talking about the genocide thing, you know, again, like if you had any doubts that this was genocide and, you know, I get kind of the debate over the word, you know, what do you define as a genocide? It's almost kind of an annoying debate. If you look at what's happening right now in North Gaza, I mean, that's genocide, ethnic cleansing with the threat of, if you don't leave, we're going to kill you. I mean, that is, that is genocide. And there are killing, you know, hundreds have been killed and, you know, you see the pictures, it's so many children, so many women being slaughtered, every day, dozens every day. And, you know, we don't know how many Hamas guys are mixed in there, but at this point, if you're in Gaza, if you're a man in Gaza, then you're a target. I mean, that's the way it's been, but it's just absolutely horrific, everything that's happening there again every day. You know, these schools where all these civilians are sheltering, you know, there was one recently that killed like 20 something people and 15 of them were kids. And I mean, you could see, because we have a Reuters account now for pictures at antiwar.com. And I mean, looking through the pictures, you could count the bodies of children. I mean, it's so horrific. And that's every day they kill all these kids. I mean, you just look at the child deaths. And then you have all those American doctors who went to Gaza. And the things that they said, that almost every day they treated children or saw children with gunshot wounds to the head or the chest. I mean, you know, that's not accidental. So, yeah, I mean, this is why we call him Genocide Joe and Kamala Harris. You know, I was tweeting today about it. Kamala Harris, this story from The Atlantic, which I haven't even bothered reading, about Trump and saying things about Hitler. It just seems so stupid. But, you know, you have Kamala Harris come out and say, oh, Trump is, you know, said something nice about Hitler. Can you believe it? But it's like, you're literally supporting and enabling a genocide of, you know, right now, a slaughter of women and children, you know, something that we haven't seen in, you know, this century. This is the most brutal thing. And you're supporting it and you're telling us you're going to keep supporting it and funding it. So it's just like, man, and it's very, just the fact that it's not really a big factor, it doesn't seem like in the vote this year.
Yeah, I tweeted out earlier that, like, I really hope that if Kamala Harris loses, and I think she's probably going to, then I hope it's largely responsible due to the fact that the more radical left portion of America just can't stand what's going on in Gaza right now. And I hope they stick that in her face and hang that around her and Joe Biden's neck every single day. And that's not to be mistaken for thinking that Trump's going to be any better, because I think this is where people go wrong. There was that one dude who was like screaming, saying, oh, you survived 4 years of Trump. It's like, yeah, but I mean, if this happened under Trump's watch, I don't think he would have hesitated. He would have told fucking Bibi, take the gloves off. Now, granted, I don't think Joe Biden would, you know, I think it would largely look the same because Joe Biden is so in Israel's pocket, so to speak. But one thing I wanted to ask both you guys about, and Carney, you could take this one, but I think it was Chris Hedges where I originally heard this idea, where he said, I think some of the estimates about the total dead in Gaza was anywhere from like 118 to 200,000 people by some estimates because of all the destruction. But obviously the official Gaza death toll is 42, almost 43,000. If I remember correctly, I was listening to your show, the one you put out this morning, Dave. What do you think about that, Connor? And then Dave, once he's done, you can kind of add your thoughts to that.
So essentially, the actual Gaza Health Ministry death toll and the accounting for all the wounded and maimed, this comes from people that they can directly confirm. So these are not the thousands, the low estimate is 10,000. There's no way that's accurate, because there's 40 million tons of rubble in Gaza right now, at least. Holy shit. That's from the UN. So this number that hasn't really shifted since November of last year, about at least 10,000 people being missing or presumed dead under the rubble, seems like a massive undercount. Now, according to those 99 American doctors, surgeons, nurses, nurse practitioners, et cetera, who went to Gaza and served in all these medical centers and hospitals, they say, as Dave said, that the minimum is 118,000 people who have been killed and starved to death. Now, they talk about, and I have this article where I put together all these quotes from doctors over the last several months who have been there. They talk about babies starving to death shortly after they're born because there's no clean formula. The women are malnourished. They can't breastfeed, et cetera. Everybody in the Gaza Strip is sick and malnourished. They talk about, you know, constantly every day they treat preteen toddlers who have been shot in the head. Dr. Mark Perlmutter said that I, for the first time, held a baby's brains in my hand in Gaza. And he goes, and it was the first of many. They all say it's worse than anything they've ever seen, any natural disaster, any other war zone, you know, ground zero on 9/11. They say it's absolutely the carnage on the first day dwarfed anything that they had experienced in the past. And so by my count, you're looking at least, so it's like over 43,000 people have officially been killed in Gaza, and nobody disputes that. Then you have over 100,000 wounded, maimed, and mutilated. And that's about 143,000, 144,000. Now you have to add the difference there. So if you look at, like well over 200,000 people that have been killed or maimed in this assault. And what I mean to say with the genocide question, you know, if somebody wanted to, they could say that the Azerbaijan ethnic cleansing of Nagorno-Karabakh, of the ethnic Armenians there, was a genocide because they did push them out of their land. Okay, so, but in Gaza, with that general's plan, and given the fact that they've already seized 26% of the territory between the Netrazim corridor, the Philadelphia corridor, as well as this buffer zone that they built a kilometer into Gaza along the entire border it shares with Israel proper, on top of the fact that the general's plan is, the point of it is to finish ethnically cleansing northern Gaza. So once they set that deadline, they're going to kill everybody there, men, women, and children. The Palestinians there are not leaving. You don't have doctors leaving their hospitals even when they're told to, because they know there's no place to go. Those safe zones are consistently bombed, and there's no water. There's no running water there. There's no bathrooms. There's no provisions for medicine. They don't have food there, and they're getting exploded with 2,000-pound bombs, as we've seen numerous times in just the Al-Mawasi camp. If people want to look that up, you can find all kinds of articles about how many times it's been bombed. And so once they're done with that, the plan is to then move all the way to the Philadelphia corridor doing this exact same project. And so there, by that, I mean that there is no dispute. What they're at least trying to do, and maybe I shouldn't say ethnically cleanse an entire nation, because that would include the West Bank and as well as East Jerusalem, but certainly in Gaza. And Dave covers this all the time. We just saw the Resettle Gaza conference on the southern border, where you have Itamar Ben-Gvir, the national security minister, May Golan, the social equality minister, along with at least 10 Likudniks from the Knesset, saying, absolutely, we are going to take Gaza. We're going to reestablish our Jewish settlements. We're taking the land. And the plan is to, frankly, do that in the West Bank. And some of them have even crazier plans for Greater Israel, like going all the way to the Nile River. Basically, what we're looking at is the first phase of the final Nakba of the Palestinians. They have launched this thing, Operation Summer Camps, in the West Bank, and particularly focusing on the north in places like Tulkarm and Jenin, where they are absolutely bringing the level of savagery we've seen in Gaza and some places there, where they are using airstrikes, but they're using bulldozers and tanks and all these other armored vehicles and massive teams of troops to go in and just rip up all the infrastructure, all the water, all the electricity, all the communications, destroy the shops, destroy the, you know, lay siege to hospitals and basically make it uninhabitable, which is what we've seen in Gaza. So that's what I mean about there not being a real debate. And then as far as the death toll, I mean, we don't really know, but according to those, it's over 118,000 because they've seen so many people starve to death. I mean, the numbers just don't seem realistic with the level of the length of the siege and the severity of it. I just saw a report I need to get into later today about how since October 7th, something like 250,000 aid trucks have been turned away. And remember, they needed at least 500 before this war. They need much more than that. They needed at least 500 a day just to sustain the population there. And it's, I mean, this is for the longest time now, we've known that, at best you could get maybe several dozen trucks coming in on the best days. And that has not been happening. We're seeing the ramifications of it and seeing the devastation. And like I said, I mean, they're destroying everything that's been converted into a shelter because there's virtually nothing left. I mean, more than half of all the housing and infrastructure has been destroyed. And that's a months old statistic from the UN. I imagine that the death toll is much worse than we actually can really fathom right now. But currently, I'm saying about 215 or so thousand people have been killed and wounded as a result of this.
Wow. Yep. Yeah, Dave, what do you think about the higher estimate of over 200,000? Do you think that's accurate, or what are your kind of thoughts? I was kind of battling with this the other day because when I was talking to my one friend about it, I remember I'm like, well, the problem is that like they've killed so many people that it's almost hard for some of them to even like continue identifying people because just the mass destruction, how many people have been cleansed. So yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, over 200,000, if we're talking killed, I mean, it's tough to really have any idea when you get up to that number. I mean, the Gaza Health Ministry, their number is around 42,000 killed now. And the way that they count is by counting the bodies that come to the hospitals and morgues. And Connor mentioned there's a lot of bodies under the rubble. And then it is also, you have those doctors who were there, the things that they described, and one of them was saying, newborn babies were dying almost every day. There was a high birth rate in Gaza before this, so there's a lot of pregnant women. I think a lot, there's probably, it could account for thousands of deaths, newborn babies dying. I think when I write this up, I always cover the health ministry's number because I think it's good to just track the daily, destruction, death and destruction. Mm-hmm. And it gives us a sense of kind of the scale of it every day. Sometimes it'll be close to 100. Sometimes it'll be, lower. But lately, since they started this thing in the north, it's been a lot every day. I think it's safe to say like around 100,000 people have probably been killed by violence and by the siege. But what Connor's saying, 215,000 killed and wounded is definitely true. Wow. Because the number of wounded recorded by the health ministry is over 100,000. Yeah. It just crossed 100,000. And you got to figure, if you see what's going on in these hospitals, if you're wounded in an airstrike or wounded by something and it's not that bad, you're probably staying out of those hospitals. I mean, they're like just horror scenes in there every day, bloody dead kids on the floor. So I'm sure the actual wounded is much higher than that. We're talking casualties. I think it's safe to say over 200,000. Talking deaths, I think probably somewhere around, maybe around 100,000. The health ministry's numbers got a little fuzzy at one point because for the first few months they were doing what they do, and this is what they've done in previous conflicts, very meticulous. You had Biden claim that you couldn't trust their numbers, and then even after that, you had the State Department say, well, actually, we probably think the true number is higher. There's an Israeli media report that said that the Israeli military was using those numbers to figure out how many civilians they were killing, the number of women and children. And then there was a point after like all the infrastructure was so badly destroyed that their communication broke down, and they said that they were counting bodies based on credible media reports.
Right.
But then they went back to the only counting the bodies that come in, and now they're working to identify all of them. Mm-hmm. And their latest update on that was that they've identified like 40,000. They released the names of 34,000 people, but they say they've already identified 40.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
3,000 at this point. And then you have that. You're going to get these kind of groups that track these things. They're going to cross-check. They're going to pick like a sample of 1,000 names or something and cross-check them. So I think it's going to turn out that the health ministry's numbers are definitely not an overcount. You know, if anything, an undercount.
Yeah, I mean, with that list of 34,000 plus names, you had 710 infants less than a year old who had been killed throughout the war. So, I mean, also, yeah, I mean, simply what I'm doing, as Dave was saying, is taking that doctor's estimate, which seems most credible at this point, I think, to me, because the you can't just look at the bodies that are going to the morgues and the hospitals and assume that's all of them, because as we know, they every time they write up a report, and Dave covers this every day, the health ministry puts out a statement where they say it's like a it's always the same. They say we cannot get all the bodies. The civil defense crews and first responders cannot reach them because they're strewn across the streets, or they're buried in the sand, or they're under the rubble. And so they can't get to them. And, you know, the other issue is how many of these people are being kidnapped and taken to these torture prisons, which we've gotten so much reporting on from every international and national media outlet in Israel and the United States and then elsewhere about what's going on there. And then periodically, like every month or two, the Israelis will drive a truck into Gaza hospital, and then they have like nearly like somewhere between 80 and 100 decomposed bodies of Palestinians who cannot be identified. We don't know where
they're truck of dead bodies in, of decomposed bodies in. It's crazy. And then we've also seen there's been videos of, there was one video I remember of some Palestinians walking along the beach, and they get shot and killed, and then the bulldozers come and just bury them, you know? So like
how often does that happen?
They're not being counted. Yeah. That's the question.
And then there was that video that I think everybody saw going around on Twitter, where it was just some people, I think there was a kid in the middle of like a lot or something like that. And then a whole bunch of people kind of came around him, and then they just dropped a fucking bomb on him. And, you know, the one lady was telling the dad to like get back from the window, and, you know, the one video you played on your show of the one guy got hit with a drone strike, and then they hit him, I think, what was it, another two times? I mean, just the savagery, high-tech savagery every single day.
And so there was this thing in CNN. I haven't written this up yet because I'm just trying to wrap my mind around it, trying to figure out how to do it.
Oh, no.
There's this big report in CNN about that, you know, they try to make you feel bad for the Israeli soldiers, saying that they have PTSD and that they left Gaza, but their minds haven't left Gaza.
Yeah.
And then you learn while reading that one of these soldiers, one of the things he has, you know, is traumatized about is that he was a bulldozer operator, and said that at time, you know, they had to run over bodies with the bulldozers, sometimes hundreds at a time, and sometimes the people were alive. And that's what he, I mean, it's like, the fact that that's buried in the story, like the headline is about supposed to make you feel bad.
Burying the lead. Yeah.
And it's like, what? I mean, it's like, man. So, you know, he's saying he's running over, if they're running over hundreds of bodies with a bulldozer and that's like a regular thing. I mean, I assume that they're burying those bodies or something. I mean, it's just, again, that's just brutality that you can't even imagine. And the way they describe it, he says it's like meat, like squirting out. Like he can't eat meat anymore because he did that. And it's just
God.
Phew. And then again, you know, 972 magazine, this Israeli magazine, they've had all this reporting about, you know, the shoot, you know, the in these, what they call these closed military zones, anybody is a target. They could shoot and kill anybody. Mm-hmm. And they reported that Israel was purposely targeting civilian buildings.
All right.
You know, so it's like, there's no question that they purposely target civilians. And we'll never know how many. We'll never know how many of the men killed are Hamas fighters or just fighters or just people. Because if you put yourself in their shoes, like, are you not going to pick up a rifle and try to kill some IDF soldiers if your whole family's been killed? You know, especially at this point, like now it's kind of irrelevant, this idea of Hamas. It's like, yeah, they're still fighting. That, you know, the Qassam's Brigade and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, they put out updates. Some they still put out videos once in a while. But I mean, it's like at this point, all this death, all these kids being killed, it's like, if you're you know, you just, again, put yourself in their shoes. Are you not going to try to fight?
All right.
Yeah. And I'll just say that I've seen a lot of Zionists and, you know, people who like are professional Hasbara you know, weavers. So I get, what's that guy's name? Constantine Kissin or something.
Yeah. Constantine Kissin.
He goes, he talks about the ratio of Hamas killed to civilians. And he says something like, it's the greatest ratio in the history of modern warfare.
No, that's what we always hear.
That's completely made up. He has no idea how many Hamas people have been killed. None. He has no idea. The IDF doesn't have any reliable numbers for that. No one does. The same way we're trying to figure out what the actual death toll in Gaza is, and the best we can work with is estimates, shows that A, he doesn't know what the ratio is, and B, the Israelis can say whatever they want about how many people, how many Hamas fighters they've killed. It doesn't, there's no proof of that. You can't quantify it. And as Dave said, they're recruiting actively new members of Hamas every day just through their military operations and orphaning all these kids. And that's going to be a long-term problem. But unfortunately, you know, whatever, I mean, I commend Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad for protecting their people as best they can. I'm not endorsing, you know, killing of civilians or anything like that, but just saying like they're not having a strong impact on the Israeli military. The Israeli military may be overstretched and getting exhausted to some degree and feeling, I don't know, suffering with PTSD. They talked about how in that CNN article, psychologists are telling them, well, you just have to normalize what you did over there. You have to understand it's remember October 7th, God. You know, and why you went to Gaza in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, it's the same thing with Hezbollah. You were asking, like, do they have the ability to really impact Israel? It doesn't appear like, I mean, yes, on the ground, we're seeing some Israeli casualties. But I mean, unless there's a full blown war and Iran really does take the gloves off. And as Dave said, we've seen that they can bypass Israeli air defenses with their ballistic missiles. It was much more pinpoint in this last strike, and they did not give the same kind of warning or use the same kind of munitions. Like they sent all those drones over there to be shot down, and ballistic missiles, only a few got through on that first one after the April 1st bombing of the consulate in Damascus. I mean, we could see a much wider attack if Israel doesn't play its cards right here. And in that case, Hezbollah may just, you know, launch all of their missiles that they have buried underground, which is somewhere between like 100,000 by a lot of estimates. And so, you know, but at this point, no one really seems to be able to stop them. What Hezbollah was trying to do originally was take away assets and resources from the IDF so that they couldn't just go all out and finish the genocide in Gaza. They wanted to give them a reason to pull their forces to the north so that they would be split and stretched and strained. But again, as you can see, they really don't have a problem finishing off of Gaza. And people go, well, they could have just turned it into a parking lot or something. They realistically couldn't have done that for political reasons. Yeah. I mean, they are an absolute parasitic pariah state. And they're turning the United States into a pariah state every single day. But they couldn't have just killed 2 million people in one day. That's just nonsense and more Israeli pseudo bravado and, you know, macho posturing and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. What they're doing, the same thing. They're just, it's a protracted genocide. And so, I mean, it's very unfortunate to see here. But like I said, I mean, I don't see anybody really coming to save the Palestinians. The only people that can actually do that are the American people.
I saw Sam Husseini tweet something. He said, the reality is the axis of resistance is not hitting Israel hard enough to stop them. They're just hitting them hard enough to help them enforce this phony victim narrative. And he was exactly right, because, you know, more so back in April when Iran attacked Israel, back then, you know, in the spring, there was a lot of pressure, it seemed like, growing from Democrats against this. And it really did seem to be significant, moving in a certain direction. Then Iran launched those missiles and drones, and you know, you watch the mainstream coverage of it. I mean, they didn't even mention why Iran attacked Israel. And
it's just Iran attacks Israel. And not to mention, who was it? Corey Bush and Jamal Bowman got both thrown out of their primaries by AIPAC.
Yeah.
I mean, they brazenly bragged that they threw them out of their own primaries. So yeah, Jesus.
Yeah, so that awful. So like after that strike, then everybody had to come out and say, "Oh, we stand with Israel, and let's give them more military aid." Right. And that's what's going to happen if Israel really starts hitting Israel hard. And that's something this guy, I forget it, Harrison Mann, I think his name was. He was a major in the U.S. Army. He was in the Pentagon Defense Intelligence Agency. He resigned over U.S. support for Israel. Said, you know, he thought, because he was just out, you know, fresh out, and said in an interview that he thought if Hezbollah, you know, which people thought Hezbollah could do more damage than they've been doing to Israel. He said if they really start hitting Israeli cities like we've never seen before, then the U.S. is probably is going to get directly involved. Like the U.S. isn't going to just sit back while that happens. So this is the risk is, you know, it's always the risk is that if this does turn into a bigger war, then the U.S. is going to get directly involved. They already are directly involved to an extent by helping intercept the missiles. And they just right. deployed this missile system to Israel. So, you know, this is the thing. It's like people act like, you know, this is just we just hate Israel so much for no reason. But it's like, yeah. You know, besides their actions against the Palestinians, they're also trying to drag the U.S. into a war that is going to get a lot of Americans killed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I should say the Shiite militias in Iraq and Syria don't really have the capability to put to do any real damage to Israel. I mean, if you just look at a map, if they try to get to even the West Bank, they're going to get shot to death and bombed before they ever get there. What they can do is they can kill a lot of American troops who are illegally occupying Syria and who are we still have at least 2,500 troops in Iraq. And there's no sign of them leaving anytime soon. And so, and in the meantime, those guys are all sitting ducks. And we've seen Iran make efforts to try and calm down those militias. And they have been able to, where for months they've gotten them to cease their attacks, where previously after the war started, there were hundreds of strikes on American illegal bases in Syria, for instance. And we've seen American troops already die. National Guard troops from my state, from Arizona, shout out to Defend the Guard for stopping this. But they were at the Tower 22 base in Jordan on the Syria border, and they got killed for U.S. support for Israel and their war on the Palestinians. And and this is what people have to realize. Like, the other thing is what I just say right here. Axis of resistance, their enemies are Israel, the United States, Al-Qaeda, and ISIS. Israel and Al-Qaeda and ISIS have these enemies. They're all the same. But we've been attacked, particularly on 9/11, by these terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda, specifically because of U.S. support for wars that were not nearly this bad. The illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and their war in southern Lebanon and their occupation from 82 to 2000 before Hezbollah pushed them out. That's why we were attacked on 9/11. Now we're openly exterminating the Palestinians, and we could be moving toward doing the same kind of thing, at least with the Shiites in Lebanon. And they're going to ethnically cleanse southern Lebanon up to the Litani River and put settlements there. I mean, it's just absolutely insane. And we're begging to be attacked by Al-Qaeda right now. And when that happens, just imagine what the United States is going to do. But in the meantime, we're fighting all of their fiercest regional enemies and trying to eliminate them. So the strategy makes absolutely no sense. And only because of the fact that we are tied at the hip for all kinds of reasons, the number one being the Israel lobby, the worst being the Israel lobby, to this commitment to this Israeli apartheid state that's hell-bent on, you know, setting the whole region on fire. And you talk about the Houthis. I mean, they're already, they own a capability to hit Tel Aviv directly with their ballistic missiles, their drones. The U.S. has been, you know, we've launched hundreds of strikes on Yemen. Again, this is a country already committed a genocide against and killed nearly 400,000 people, mostly children and infants. And now we're back to bombing them again. But if they ever get, you know, if the blockade ever gets lifted on Yemen, just imagine what the Houthis can be capable of doing. And they're going to have great reason to do it. I mean, this is just, I'm not saying they're going to attack the United States. They could come after Israel. I'm sure that they would if they could. They're doing everything they can right now, and there's no stopping them. I mean, we have U.S. naval commanders going, you know, this is the biggest battle since World War II against this, you know, the Houthis. They did, in a way, defeat the American Empire here. I mean, with the Gaza genocide, because Saudi Arabia doesn't even want to fight them anymore. The Americans do. The Saudis aren't bombing the Houthis right now. but they stood them off for that war from 2015 until early 2022, and they're not going to stop. And now they're saying they won't stop their attacks on Israel until Israel ends its wars, not only in Gaza, but also in Lebanon. It's in solidarity with those groups. And the way Israel is working is it's almost pushing the U.S. and Iran into a massive war that neither side wants. But because the American people are not willing to, well, because Washington is not willing to use its pressure with Israel and its leverage with Israel to end the war and end the occupation and the siege and the ethnic cleansing, they're pushing the U.S. and Iran into war that neither side wants. The American people, like I said, we're the only ones, and I don't know how. I don't have any great ideas for this, but we do have to do something, because otherwise, this could push the United States off the cliff of everything. If we get attacked by Al Qaeda, just imagine what the U.S. is going to do. I mean, we'll go into being like at least an overtly totalitarian state. And it's all going to be for Tel Aviv. Mm-hmm. And it's just very disappointing. And, you know, this kind of war could, you know, we're already bankrupt, but imagine the economic crisis that's going to blow back on the United States. Not only that, but just how many American troops are going to die, because this is going to be a war that'll be worse than the post 9/11 wars in all likelihood. So you're talking about millions and millions of people killed and displaced.
Yeah. I'll answer these super chats backwards. So thank you so much, Conrail and Abrogate These for the $4.99 and $20 super chat. But real quick first, Dave, I'll throw this one to you. If I may ask Conrail for the $4.99, if I may ask a question, if Osama bin Laden were alive today and were leading Al-Qaeda, would he have aided Israel and America in overthrow Middle Eastern regimes? And then after that, Connor, did Defend the Guard in Arizona stop National Guard deployments to Iraq or Syria? Connor, I'm confused. Dave and Connor, you could follow up with this as well. What do you guys think about Osama bin Laden, what he would be doing right now?
What would Osama be up to today if he was still alive? Well, one thing, I mean, you saw, it's hard to know if these videos are real. I know some of them are fake, but I know the Al-Qaeda guys in Idlib were happy when Israel killed Nasrallah. And they're happy when Israel kills the IRGC guys in Syria and Iraq. So if Osama was alive today and kind of still leading Al-Qaeda, he might be, I think he wouldn't do it openly, but he might be on the side of Israel against Lebanon and maybe Iran if an Iran-Israel war starts. But one thing that those groups, you know, you talk about ISIS, like if they really do want to reconstitute, you know, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, which, I mean, they're just like little camps now of ISIS. They don't have any real territory, but they certainly benefit from a U.S.-Iran war. Iran is like a big regional war. I think that might be their, you know, strategy if they want to caliphate again, to kind of sit back and stoke the tensions and hope that a full blown war breaks out and then try to take some territory in Syria or something.
Well, yeah, I mean, and also, if you look at what ISIS's activity has been throughout this since October 7th, they've been attacking Israel's enemies. They've been attacking the Syrian Arab army. They bombed the tomb of General Qasem Soleimani on the anniversary of his death, January 3rd. They're not attacking Israel. They've never attacked, I shouldn't say ISIS. ISIS attacked Israel once by accident and apologized. and you can look that up. Al-Qaeda's never attacked Israel. Now, I'm not saying that Al-Qaeda is run by Israel or anything like that. They have a lot of influence from Saudi intelligence in the U.S. There's no doubt about that. Now, in Syria, where we had the dirty war against Damascus and the attempt to overthrow Bashar al-Assad for all those years, the CIA running the war, the Israeli position was we want both sides to hemorrhage themselves to death, although they did take ISIS's side, particularly in the southwest, and they had them create what they call a buffer zone around the occupied Golan Heights. And so there was, and they were providing them weapons and medical care and taking in wounded fighters and treating them in Israeli hospitals and this kind of thing. So there is a relationship there. Israel is a benefactor of Al-Qaeda and ISIS in the region. As far as what was, and also I should add that Hezbollah, you know, I think a lot of people thought, and certainly I did, that Hezbollah got battle hardened through helping destroy the Islamic State caliphate in Syria. Along with the Syrian Arab Army and the IRGC, and then, of course, Russia and the Kurds and the Americans. But the other way of looking at that is maybe they got bled by doing that. because they don't appear to be as strong as we thought that they were. And that may have been a big part of the strategy, is to just bleed the axis of resistance in this battlefield in Syria that we kind of foment and create with this war, and drain them of their resources, so that when we do inevitably go for this major attack in Lebanon or ethnic cleansing plan in Palestine, which I think they were, you know, it appears that obviously they were waiting for the right casus belli to do that. It's not like the Israelis were going to keep the Palestinians permanently under occupation because they have all these concerns about the Palestinian population exceeding the Israelis, which would cause all kinds of problems from their perspective. And that's one of the reasons why Gaza was put under a blockade and put under a diet, as they've talked about. You know, the axis of resistance might be in a weaker position now than they would have been otherwise if the dirty war in Syria hadn't taken place. As far as bin Laden goes, I think we'd be really, really screwed right now if he were alive, because he was he's much more charismatic and influential of a leader than Ayman al-Zawahiri ever was. Jelani basically works for the CIA in Syria. I mean, the Dave was saying, you got the Al-Qaeda fighters and the ISIS fighters. The remnants of them primarily are located in the Idlib province. And you have Turkey there, who's been a major benefactor of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, occupying that territory up in the north. And the U.S. occupies about a third of northeastern Syria, stealing the people's oil and wheat resources, but they're also allowing ISIS to fester, right? And that's part of the policy, really. I mean, not explicitly, but they are preventing, by being there, they are preventing the Syrian Arab Army and their partners from going in and cleaning out the rest of Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And so if bin Laden were around, I don't exactly know what position he could have done what Dave said, but I imagine that we probably would have been hit many times already if he was in power. I mean, a big part of his doctrine was, we need to liberate Jerusalem. The way to do that is to attack the Americans constantly, bring them in to the Middle East and bleed them dry, bankrupt them and push them out of the region so that we can overthrow these corrupt governments that rule over us, that are all underwritten. Their power is all underwritten totally by the United States. And Zawahiri also felt the same way, that you attack the Americans, they're the far enemy, push them out, then you can do what you want. You have to overthrow these other client governments after that, and then you can build your Islamic State caliphate. But again, I mean, we've been back in Al-Qaeda for so long, in so many different theaters, going back to the 80s, and then, of course, the 90s in Bosnia and Chechnya and Kosovo, and then in Syria and in Yemen and in Libya. I mean, Donald Trump backed Al-Qaeda and ISIS for 4 years straight while he was committing a genocide against the poorest nation in the Middle East, after he proclaimed on the campaign trail, I'm going to bomb the shit out of ISIS. But he made them partners in his coalition with the Saudis and the UAE for that whole time. So, you know, it is not a policy of the American people really to get rid of Al-Qaeda. You know, they've always been, just like Iran for Israel, they're the greatest excuse for these expansionist policies in the Middle East, that conveniently Israel always has a big hand in helping us pick which countries to go to war with. And we constantly are attacking Israel's enemies, who also happen to be Al-Qaeda's enemies. And that's something else to keep in mind. I mean, look at Saddam Hussein being a prime example.
Okay. So, and then real quick, about the Defend the Guard in Arizona stop national deployments to Iraq or Syria. Do you know anything about that, Connor?
No, I mean, they haven't. But the point is that we want them to be able to do that and make it legal for the U.S. to send over National Guard troops absent a formal declaration of war per Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. That's the only way you can do it.
And well, I think his angle was, did it pass in Arizona, or like did it go to the legislature?
It passed the Senate, I think. Okay. But no, when Connor was talking about it before, he said something about Defend the Guard stop the deployments, but...
No, I said shout out to Defend the Guard for trying to stop that.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. That might have been why he was confused.
But they're trying. Okay. Yeah, Arizona, I think it has a good shot of eventually passing Arizona. It passed the Senate, I think, maybe twice.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But then never got signed into law.
Because I know Wendy Rogers reintroduced it after that. So it was actually it was three U.S. Army Reserve soldiers from Georgia who died in that attack. But it was like 40-something Arizona National Guard who were wounded.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Crazy.
Okay, yeah. Wow. Okay, I mean, you know, I talk about a silver lining. Real quick before we close out here, because Dave, I know you didn't want to go much longer past an hour. We're 2 weeks away from the election. I'm 2 weeks away from becoming 30 years old. what do you think about Trump versus Kamala? How do you think foreign policy is going to carry out? I think I know your answer, and I think I agree with your answer, but go ahead, take it away, and then Connor, you can answer after him.
Oh, how things could change depending on who wins, you mean? Like,
yes.
You know, I think either way, Ukraine is going to, the proxy war is going to wind down. I mean, Zelensky seems to be just like flailing right now.
Yeah.
And, you know, Biden's team is just like, all right, let's just get past the election and not, let's just, you know, keep sending them weapons. Here's another few hundred million. Yeah. And then they're going to kind of sit down and figure out what they're going to do, I think, after the election, if Kamala wins. Mm-hmm. And I mean, Ukrainians think that the U.S. support is going to wane either way. I do think with Trump, it could be better with Ukraine. Like, I do think it is significant that you have him running on ending the war and Kamala running on continuing it. With Trump, though, you just never know. I mean, we're not really going to know until he starts filling out his cabinet, yeah. I think. But I do think that there's influential China hawks that are going to get in that do actually want to wind down the proxy war in Ukraine. They don't want to end it. And if you look at what J.D. Vance, you know, his plans that he said, he doesn't, he wants to, you know, give Ukraine some kind of aid, basically like a demilitarized yeah. zone, a frozen conflict, but I do think there's more of a chance of that winding down if Trump wins, because again, you get those China hawks, you know, there are the people very hawkish on China who do want that stuff to wind down in Ukraine. So,
yeah.
But then when it comes to Israel, I mean, you know, if Trump puts, if David Friedman's back, he just wrote a book where he says the U.S. should fund the annexation of the West Bank and they should move all the Palestinians out. You got Miriam Adelson. If Jared Kushner comes in, I think the plan is going to be, all right, let's bribe the Egyptians to let the Palestinians in and
Abraham, do whatever you want in the West Bank. Basically.
Yeah, I think that's probably, we would probably see something like that. And I think Kushner is like working on the, with the transition team or something. So he's going to be in there at some point. And so, it's going to be bad either way, but you know, I get why people would vote for Trump because the Ukraine war, that risk of nuclear escalation is very big. And I think at least like even just a change, you know, could be better. Kamala, you know, she's going to do whatever the, you know, Democratic establishment wants basically.
Right. Yeah. Connor, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I agree with Dave about the possibilities for the Ukraine war being wound down are more likely with Trump. And that could be, I mean, exactly because you have all those China hawks who do want to shift more assets and resources in preparation for that war, which is
right.
apparently going to be a direct hot war with China, not a proxy war kind of thing we've seen with Russia. And at the same time, if the war really expands in the Middle East, there's just, it's not the American military and the empire is just not going to be able to continue funding Ukraine to nearly the, or backing them to nearly the same degree, because it's going to demand such a diversion of resources, which we're already seeing to Israel. I mean, they get preference beyond anybody else for their war and their project, their ethnic cleansing project. So, you know, with Trump, I agree that the ethnic cleansing of the West Bank is going to ramp up. Now, I don't know exactly to what degree they're going to do that. If they want to kick out the millions of Palestinian Muslims and Christians in the West Bank, I mean, maybe they'll just do a fully ethnically cleansed Area C or something else like that. But whatever they do decide to do, if they go into especially like East Jerusalem and start attacking the Al-Aqsa Mosque or try to destroy it, that could cause a war that I don't even think we can really fathom yet. It's not really clear at all how the regional actors there are going to respond to that. We could mm-hmm. see a scenario where the U.S. basically with Israel is at war with the entire region.
I think it would probably start slow, like you said, like Area yeah. C. You know, there was that peace plan. They called it a peace plan that Kushner came up with under Trump. I think maybe they would go to annex those areas, which is kind of along the Jordan Valley and then all the settlements and around them, mm-hmm. you know, to like yeah. officially, even though, I mean, that's de facto already annexed, but I don't know. It would probably have to be a slower process than they would want.
Yeah, I mean, that would cause like a massive uproar to the point where we don't really know exactly what Egypt and Jordan and Saudi and these other states might do. And I don't think that the Abraham Accords coalition is going to hold together, really. I don't think it exists for all intents and purposes right now. I mean, maybe, yes, the UAE. I mean, I think that they're the UAE and the Saudis. I mean, these are the people that committed the Yemen genocide. I could see them saying, okay, well, we'll pay to reconstruct Gaza after you ethnically cleansed all the people that you're not going to have staffing the resorts in the settlements and this kind of thing. And, you know, we're happy to make a deal because the American Donald Trump has promised us a civilian nuclear energy program and advanced weapons we don't have access to yet and a defense guarantee and, you know, the likes of which we have with Japan or South Korea. I mean, these are the items on the table in the deal that Blinken and the Biden administration are still trying to make with Riyadh, even in spite of the genocide, which makes it politically untenable, at least in, you know, well, indefinitely, but at least for now, until the fighting in Gaza is over. But yeah, I mean, really, you look at all the states that have normalized with Iran at this point, most importantly, Saudi Arabia, which is supposed to be the crown jewel of the project, because supposedly that's supposed to open the door to ingratiating apartheid Israel with the entire Muslim world, which I don't see that as realistic. But you have the UAE has normalized relations with Iran. Bahrain is expected to do the same thing soon. I mean, Russia is brokering those kind of talks. You have Kuwait has already normalized. Sudan already normalized with Iran. So that's 3 out of the 4 Abraham Accords states. And I just saw a report in the Cradle. I don't know what's going to come of this, but you have a pretty high up Iranian naval official saying that Iran and Saudi may be carrying out joint naval drills soon. And they just wrapped some up this past weekend that Russia also and India also participated in, along with Pakistan, as they're preparing for this Israeli attack. It just doesn't seem like what they were trying to do was build a NATO-style coalition to encircle Iran for a future war. And it may have just been, you know, I mean, it might have just been a way. Michael Carrillo talked about integrating all the air and missile defenses and creating this kind of, like I say, this NATO-style coalition. And that might have not been, they didn't really intend maybe to go to war with Iran because that would be so devastating for everyone. But as we've seen as this war has progressed, the indications are that even the U.S. Gulf state dictatorship satellites do not really want this war with Iran. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you saw in the response to that, when the U.S. and France and Britain and Jordan were assisting Israel in shooting down those drones and ballistic missiles in April in response to the bombing of the consulate, there's a piece in Middle East Eye about how Kuwait and Saudi specifically made very clear to the United States that you are not to launch a retaliatory strike against Iran from the bases you have in our countries. We are not getting involved in that. We have a decent economic, we have some now, thankfully, have some economic cooperation with Iran and things are getting better in the region. We do not want war with Iran. So I really don't think anybody there wants this except for Israel and the United States. Now, that means that you're going to see a lot more money being taken out of our pockets to bribe these despots in the region that the U.S. backs in order to get them on board with whatever Kushner and Friedman's plan is, which does appear to be something. It does appear to look, you know, they're certainly going to ethnically cleanse Gaza because Kushner needs that beachfront property he's been talking about. And Friedman's plan to ethnically cleanse the West Bank, get the Americans to pay for it. As far as the Ukraine thing goes, it's to me an open question. Because Trump has been kind of incoherent in this policy. And I know that apparently Robert O'Brien and Keith Kellogg's plan is to tell Zelensky, you go to the table and negotiate or we cut off aid, and then tell the Russians that if you don't come to the table and negotiate, we're going to open the floodgates on military aid to Ukraine and escalate.
It's going to be under a loan, though. That's what we're told. It's supposed to be a loan.
We haven't heard really solid indications yet about what provinces Russia would be keeping after a settlement. And, you know, these are the most important parts of the negotiation and of the negotiations. And so we have to see what happens there. I mean, really, Trump's record on Russia is absolutely abysmal. There's yeah. just no, I mean, he's was much worse than Obama. Tore up the INF treaty, tore up the Open Skies treaty, nearly killed New START. And we're seeing the ramifications of that right now with the Typhon missile deployments that are going to be in, stationed in Germany in 2026. And we're already seeing them taken to the Philippines, Denmark for drills, as well as Japan soon. And this is all because of John Bolton and Donald Trump taking a sledgehammer to the international arms control regime between the U.S. and Russia. And then he set records for the number of sanctions he imposed. I mean, he funded the war in Ukraine against the Donbass for his whole administration and was, you know, arming them in a way that Obama never did. And we've seen them, you know, really escalate in Syria. I mean, bombing the Wagner troops there. The mercenaries in Deir ez-Zor, killing hundreds of them, apparently, or at least according to some U.S. Military officials who talked about it at the time in 2018. You know, they're committed on behalf of Israel of going after Syria relentlessly. And that's the real risk of Russia getting involved in a war if something breaks out between the U.S. and Iran. I don't see Russia getting involved in this sort of World War III scenario people talk about between the U.S. and Iran, but Israel is now bombing around Latakia, where Russia has its bases. And so if they really start attacking in those areas or make a serious move against Assad and Damascus, that's where you have to worry about Russia getting involved. But I could see them potentially providing not nearly the amount of support the U.S. has provided Ukraine for its war against the United States, Iran's that is. But they could provide them some material support. There's reports about them giving them air defenses now and S-300s and things like that to help them prepare. And so we'll have to see. I mean, it really, the problem is that the policies that, you know, we think Trump wants to implement, the good ones, are never implemented once he gets power. And his cabinet, we already know he's going to have Haley. He said absolutely that's
going to be Haley, Pompeo, Tom Cotton, just the worst.
Potentially Cotton, yeah. Could be a nightmare even compared to Blinken if he gets into the State Department.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap it. Abrogate These, dude, thank you so much for your generous donations to the show tonight. Cheers to you all. We need more episodes like this. There are a little over 300 of yins listening right now, so please make sure you hit a like, subscribe, all that good stuff. Follow me if you're not already on the Twitter and all that stuff. You guys go ahead, give your plugs. Dave, go ahead, give your plugs. And Connor after that, and we'll wrap her there.
Yeah, follow me on Twitter at DecampDave is my handle. Follow antiwar.com there too. All my writings at antiwar.com and my show, Antiwar News, I do 5 days a week. It's on YouTube, Rumble, or you could listen to the podcast.
Right on, man. Connor, good.
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Freeman's Mind 96. You can find my articles in the featured articles section at the Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org, and in the news section. And you can find my viewpoints and news articles at antiwar.com. As well, and also follow our show Conflicts of Interest, the show I co-host once a week with Kyle Anzalone, news editor at the Institute, opinion editor at antiwar.com, and Will Porter. We're at con_interest on Twitter. Thanks very much, Kyle.
Yeah, of course. All right, everybody, thank you so much, and until next time, take care. Oh, tomorrow, Q Anthony Ali, check that one out. We're gonna be talking about China, so yeah, thanks guys.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Labor Day sale and get 35% off paints and stains August 22nd through September 4th. With prices starting at $31.84, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your interior or exterior, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store or shop the sale online. Delivery available on qualifying orders. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.